Well, welcome to Mac on this Labor Day weekend. I put myself through some tough reading this past week. I read the annual report that's issued by the FBI on incidents involving hate crimes and hate speech. I'd never looked at that document before. The report for last year, covering 2018, will be released in just a few weeks, but the 2017 report is out. You can Google it and look at it. Recorded over 7,000 documented hate crime incidents in the United States. Over 7,000 in 12 months. And nearly 5,000 of them were motivated by race, ethnicity, or heritage. That's up by nearly 1,000 over the previous year. And when the new report is released in just a handful of weeks, it's expected to show another dramatic rise over the year before. We've been in a series, as you heard, if you're just joining us, delving into one of the most pivotal cultural issues of our day, which is racism. And we're bringing it to an end today. We started off with just a theology of race, just kind of grounding ourselves in what Scripture has to say about just race in general. I mean, what is race? How did it come into being? How did it flow from Adam and Eve in creation? And what is its role in God's vision for the human race? What did he intend by creating us a different colored skin mosaic? Then last week, we looked at racism itself, the nature of its distortion of God's dream, the nature of its evil, and it is a great evil. And then we looked at how a shadow racism can rear its head in our lives. I mean, you talk to the average person, they would say, look, there's not a racist bone in my body. I hate that as much as anybody. But then we make racist decisions, or we make racist comments, or we make racist acts, and we're not even hardly aware of it. So we looked at how a shadow racism can rear its head as we live out. Well, today we bring the series to an end with a look at a parallel dynamic to all this, which is a loss of civility. And I really don't know how to put this other than to say there's just a nastiness permeating our world, exacerbated by social media that takes every disagreement, every division, every prejudice, and runs straight to the lowest, coarsest level possible with it. And I don't know whether it's because we suddenly, through social media, or we're allowed to kind of let our nasty out without being seen and not having to look anybody in the eye, but it's just a mess. And I know that you think this is true too. Survey after survey shows that we all believe that hate is on the rise. This is one of the more recent ones that came out by the Barna Group. And you can see there that across every type of person, white, black, Hispanic, we all believe that the amount of hate crime and hate speech in America is on the rise right now in our world. And while many of us might not go online and say things that would be officially considered hate speech by the FBI, we are not innocent. Just exchange the word hate with snarky, critical, cutting, testy, insulting, rude, snide, mean-spirited, cruel, demeaning, condescending, dismissive. Sociologist Deborah Tannen calls ours an argument culture. It's as if we approach everything with this warlike mentality, this adversarial kind of aspect. So we end up looking at people in the world in general in an adversarial frame of mind. So how do you explore an idea? We debate. How do we cover the news? Well, you find people who express the most extreme polarizing views and present them as two sides. How do we settle a dispute? Oh, we go to court. Litigation that pits one party against the other. And the web and social media in particular has become just like this cultural social street fight. So much so that we've had to come up with a whole new vocabulary, right? Now we have trolls and trolling and all other kinds of words to describe the mess that goes on out there. And we don't seem to care who we do it to. We'll take shots at anybody, even people we should be supporting. I was reading this past week how Eddie Murphy is going to host Saturday Night Live in December for the first time in 35 years. He has not been on that show for 35 years. Do you know why it's been 35 years? Murphy saved SNL. After its original stars like Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi and Gilda Radner left. After they left and before Murphy came in, critics were not calling it Saturday Night Live. They were calling it Saturday Night Dead because it was so bad. And then Murphy came and joined the cast in 1980 at the ripe old age of 19 and lit it up. He left after 4 years or so, but he kept lighting it up and kept kind of having his success, Bowie, Saturday Night Live, because he was an alumnus, and he did movies like Trading Places and 48 Hours and Beverly Hills Cop and Coming to America. And then Murphy went through a downtime in his career. And one of the cast members of SNL made a joke of it. Like, they wrote a sketch, and they showed it on SNL about Murphy. And about how his celebrity status had diminished. He wasn't going through a good time. And here's what happened. This was back in 1995. David Spade was the one who was doing it. And he was doing a sketch where he was teaching children and showing them kind of funny things and teaching them in that way. And so he held up, one of the things he did was he held up a picture of Eddie Murphy to the kids. And he said, "Look, children, it's a falling star. Let's make a wish." Well, for Murphy, it was one thing to make a joke about one of his movies, but this was personal. This was a shot at his career, including his time on SNL. And he wanted to say, "Look, I'm one of you guys. Why are you doing this?" It hurt him. It took 35 years to get him back. Words matter. And what's so sad is that those who follow Christ were not immune from this. We can cut people down with the best of them. I once read an editorial in Christianity Today magazine that discussed how no attribute of civilized life seems more under attack right now than civility. And he was talking about civility between Christians. The author, David Aikman, wrote this. He says how Christians have turned themselves into the self-appointed attack dogs of Christendom. They seem determined to savage not only opponents of Christianity, but also fellow believers of whose doctrinal positions they disapprove. A stroll through the internet reveals websites so drenched in sarcasm and animosity that an agnostic or a follower of another faith tradition interested in what it means to become a Christian might become permanently disillusioned. He's right. It seems like anyone, Christian or not, can give themselves over to snarky tweets and snarky blogs with snarky comments. We trade in irritability and short temper. Our default mode for interaction, particularly when we disagree with someone, tends to be mean-edged sarcasm and cynicism. It's as if we don't have the maturity or the depth to make a point without it being at the end of an arrow aimed for someone's heart. And we rationalize it all away as if any time we're angry, you know, and if it's like righteous anger, we somehow get a kitchen pass and permission to be rude. We somehow get a kitchen pass. If we feel like somebody else started it, oh, we have the right to hit back in this exact same way and retaliate. And it's all fueled by this culture of offense in our day. John Bevere writes of it like the bait in a trap that ensnares us if we take it. And he calls it the bait of Satan. And it is bait, and it is a trap. Because while a particular offense might be real, we don't have to be offended. I mean, just think of our language. It really betrays us. We talk about taking offense, getting offended, becoming offended. It's as if we know intuitively, even how we talk about it, that it's something we choose to do. And when we make that choice, and you go through life with a chip on your shoulder, it leads to hurt, anger, outrage, resentment, bitterness, and hatred, which results in insults, attacks, wounding, division, arguments, and broken relationships. And we wonder why we're dealing with racism. We wonder why something like that is rearing its head in our day. It's because we've created the soil for it to flourish. We've created the atmosphere and the context for it to take root now than more than at any other time in most of our lifetimes. So let's clean this up on our end. One of the things that I've said throughout this series is that the hope of the world is the church. It's its hope. It's where real racial unity and is going to be modeled. It's the only shot at it because the world is sick and in decay. But if God's people can pull this off the way God's envisioned them to pull it off, then we have something to offer the world that it does not already have. And if we can pull off that kind of racial reconciliation and unity and take it out into the world and let them see a picture of it, then we've got a chance, friends. So let's clean up this civility stuff, at least on our end, and put that into the mix as well. Let's talk about civility and particularly how that plays out with our words and what we write and what we say and what we post. That is, if you want to follow Christ in this area. So let's begin by realizing the power of our words. In the great wisdom section of the Bible, which is called Proverbs, and it's called that because it's filled with proverbs or wisdom sayings, it says this: words kill, words give life. They're either poison or fruit. You choose. You choose. That's a strong dynamic. When it comes to words, they either kill or they give life. They're either poison or they're fruit. There's just not much middle ground. Most of what we say to others or about others is not neutral. It's potent. Now, here's how that power, that lack of neutrality, works. Let's stay with Proverbs. I'm going to read three more of its wisdom sayings. Some people make cutting remarks, but the words of the wise bring healing. A gentle answer deflects anger, but harsh words make tempers flare. Kind words heal and help. Cutting words wound and maim. And we can net that out pretty easily, can't we? On one side are words that are cutting and harsh. On the other side are words that are wise and gentle and kind. Now, words that are cutting and harsh incite anger, and they cause wounds. Words that are wise and gentle and kind cause healing and conflict resolution, and they bring aid and help and assistance. Both sets of words hold power and impact and influence, but for one, it's all destructive in nature. The other, it's all positive in nature. Which is the way to go? See, this is very, very important. When we get emotionally exercised, or we get baited, or we get tempted to give into our baser instincts that would result in harmful language, when we get tempted to write, post, tweet in a way that adds to the lack of civility in our world, even if we believe we're in the right, we're not achieving anything. We're just making things worse. So no matter how exercised you might be emotionally, no matter how mad, irate, irritated, or frustrated, ask yourself, what is the end game that you're trying to be about? More importantly, what's the end game Jesus wants you to be about? Like, what is the target on the wall? Is it more conflict? Is it more anger? Is it more wounding? Then fine, let the tweets fly. If it's healing, understanding, getting on the solution side of things, pause before you hit send. Pause before you hit post. This is how the Apostle Paul described the target on the wall in his New Testament letter to the church at Ephesus. He said, "Let everything you say be good and helpful, so that your words will be an encouragement to those who hear them." Or as Eugene Peterson phrased it, he said, "Watch the way you talk. Say only what helps. Each word a gift." So how can you begin to bring that kind of civility to the table, particularly in a politically charged, racially divided, social media-driven world? If we were to put some spiritual controls on our mouths, what would they look like? What would they entail? If we were to run everything through some kind of filter to clean it up and to guard our souls and to make the world a better place and have a positive impact, what would those filters be? Well, I spent some time really reflecting on this and going through the book of Proverbs and other passages of Scripture, and I'm convinced that if the Bible were to offer four filters for us, these would be the four. Here they are. First, ask yourself, is what I'm going to say true? If you know it's not, or if you're not sure, or if it's just rumor, or if it's just second or third hand, or if it's a caricature, or it's a stereotype, don't say it. Why? It doesn't pass the truth test. That's first. Second, is what I am going to say helpful? Because even if it gets past the first filter, meaning it really is true, doesn't make it helpful. I know a lot of true stuff that can rip and maim and hurt and destroy. Ask yourself, is it encouraging? Does it build people up? Does it bring healing and wholeness? Or our words should bring life and they should bring benefit to those who listen. Truth itself is not enough. It has to pass the why test. Why would I say this? What is my agenda here? Am I trying to hurt or help, to build up or arouse suspicion? Am I trying to prop somebody up, or am I trying to take a baseball bat to them and my bat just happens to be truth? Here's the third one. is what I'm going to say personal? Personal. In other words, am I saying it to the right person in the right way? You don't use social media to have a conversation. That should be in person and in private. I can't begin to tell you how many times I've had someone maybe try to pick a fight with me or a debate with me online or someone else on staff or someone I know, and I'll say to that person or I'll recommend that they say, look, this is not the place for this. If you want to meet for a coffee or talk on the phone, I'll be happy to do that or arrange the proper person for you to do that with, but we're not going to do this over Twitter. We're not going to do this over Facebook or anything else like that. And if somebody won't do that rote, you know, they don't have the maturity for that, they just want to keep baiting and trolling and stuff like that, then do what Jesus would do. Block them. Unfriend their butts. I might not even say butt when I do it. But here's the last filter, is what I'm going to say loving. And that may be the biggest filter of all. Because if you're seeking to be loving toward that person, you wouldn't say something that wasn't true. You wouldn't say something that wasn't helpful. And you wouldn't say anything to them or about them in a way that was inappropriate. But it's still a good separate filter to have because it speaks to how you're going to say things. Are you going to say it with grace and humility? Will it give the other person the benefit of the doubt? Or are you going to come across accusing and judgmental and sanctimonious and mean-spirited? Civility is something that is practiced, and we need so much more of its craft taking place. There's a beautiful picture of this playing out this past week of someone saying the wrong thing. It was a racially hurtful thing. They owned it. They dealt with it personally and with apology and regret, and the person on the receiving end responded to that with civility, refusing to take undue offense in a way that would just breed more hostility or division. Here's what happened. Jason Hackett and Alex Housden are co-anchors for the morning news show at Channel 5 in Oklahoma City. You may have caught wind of this. They had a segment of a video where they were showing a baby Western Lowland gorilla playing with a camera at the zoo. Now, Hackett is black. Housden is white. Listen to how the segment played out at the end.
Zoo just posted.
Okay, you have to see this. This is Finn. We're about to show. Oh my goodness. Take a look at him. He's a resident of the Oklahoma City Zoo. And this week, the zoo's ape caretaker took over their Instagram. And we are all loving that they did. And as you can see, Finn was fascinated.
Definitely ready for his close up.
Kind of looks like you. What do you see the picture?
It kind of does, actually. Yeah.
I mean, you heard right. She told her black co-anchor he looked like the gorilla. And that slur, comparing black people and those from Africa to monkeys, gorillas, or apes, is just entrenched in the history of racism. Viewers were outraged, calls for her to be fired. The comments on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter ran the gamut from horror at the remark to people trolling it to try to fan the flames of racism. But then the next day, the two anchors addressed it themselves. Take a look.
An important message from KOCO's Alex Housden and Jason Hackett.
I'm here this morning because I want to apologize not only to my co-anchor, Jason, but to our entire community. I said something yesterday that was inconsiderate, it was inappropriate, and I hurt people. And I want you to know I understand how much I hurt you out there and how much I hurt you. I love you so much, and you have been one of my best friends for the past year and a half, and I would never do anything on purpose to hurt you. And I love our community, and I want you all to know from the bottom of my heart, I apologize for what I said. I know it was wrong, and I am so sorry.
Well, Alex, thank you very much, and I do accept your apology, and I do appreciate your apology. I want to let everybody out there know that Alex is one of my best friends. I mean, we do what we do here, and you know, it's not as if we see each other here and then we leave and we go home. We talk every day or almost every other day. I've told you things. I've shared things with you as a friend, and I do appreciate you and I do love you. All that being said, and Alex would be the first to admit to this to you, what she said yesterday was wrong. It cut deep for me, and it cut deep for a lot of you in the community. I've heard the phone calls, and I've heard the Facebook messages as well. And I guess coming out of this, I want this to be a teachable moment. And that lesson here is that words matter. There's no doubt about that. changing demographics here in this country. The demographics are changing. We're becoming a more diverse country, and there's no excuse. We have to understand the stereotypes. We have to understand each other's backgrounds and the words that hurt, the words that cut deep. And we have to find a way to replace those words with love and words of affirmation as well. You know, what we do here as broadcasters, we use words. Words are the tools of our trade. Much like a plumber would use a wrench or a doctor would use a scalpel, we use words. And our goal and what we need to do is use those words not to hurt and not to divide, but to build a more perfect union. And this is going to be a journey for us. We're learning things here. And we at KOCO5 hope that you join us along on this journey. Thank you guys very much.
Okay, that's a class act. And friends, that's also the key to racial reconciliation. Because the key to racial reconciliation is for white people and black people and Asian people and Hispanic people to relate to each other as human beings, to get to know one another, to understand one another, to listen to one another, to talk to one another, to forgive one another, to broker in civility and grace the way you would want to be on the receiving end yourself of civility and grace. There is no conversation that you can't have with someone if you're being truthful, if you're being helpful, if you're being personal, if you're being loving. You can have any and every conversation with any person, and it'll bring healing and restoration and help. And isn't that what we're all longing for? Healing and restoration. Now, I know that it would be easy to be sitting there and not necessarily wrongly and saying, but the world is too dark. You know, I mean, people's hearts are too dark and impenetrable, and they're so hardened with hatred. I know. They need Jesus. There's nothing else we can say. They need Jesus. But we can model to them what Jesus looks like when it intersects the deepest needs of a life. We can show them what a community that has been infected by Jesus, we can show them what that looks like between people of different backgrounds. We can bring Jesus to the world, and the world needs him desperately. But it starts here with his people.